laws that single out a particular group of people to deny them rights do not square with the U.S. Constitution.
Five couples challenge Alaska's ban on gay marriage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Southeast residents worry about a mining boom in Canada.
We really see this as a tremendous mining binge in the BC side of the Southeast Alaska BC transboundary region here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Alaska was the first state in the country to add a ban on same-sex marriage to its constitution. Now, five gay couples are trying to strike that ban down. The complaint is being filed in federal district court today, and it names Governor Sean Parnell as the lead defendant. The parties are challenging the ban on the grounds that it violates the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the U.S. Constitution. Caitlin Shortell is one of three attorneys representing the couples.
I think there's a very strong growing recognition that laws that single out a particular group of people to deny them rights do not square with the U.S. Constitution, and in fact, not with the Alaska Constitution.
All but one of the couples challenging the ban have already been married in other states, but their marriages are not recognized by Alaska because of the ban that was instated in 1998. The fifth couple is unmarried but would like to wed in Alaska. Because the state officials named in suit have not seen the complaint, a spokesperson from the Department of Law could not comment on the case. The state Supreme Court has ruled as recently as last month that gay couples need to be treated equally under law in situations like employee benefits and tax breaks, but it has skirted the question of whether the marriage ban conflicts with other parts of the Alaska Constitution. Last summer, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that the federal government must recognize same-sex marriages. Federal judges have struck down marriage bans in several states since that ruling. Pacific walruses have been removed from the unusual mortality event declared in the North Pacific for several marine mammal species. From member station KDLG, Mike Mason reports.
Last week, the Working Group on Marine Mammal Unusual Mortality Events made the decision to remove Pacific walruses from the list of animals currently being affected by the still unknown disease that first showed up back in 2011. That's because no new cases have been detected. Julie Spiegel is a spokesperson for NOAA.
The unusual mortality event will stay open for Alaskan ice seals. So those are primarily ringed seals, bearded seals, ribbon seals, and spotted seals. Most of the disease cases have been with the ringed seals.
In July of 2011, NOAA and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service received reports of sick or dead ice seals across the North Slope and the Bering Strait regions. Many of the seals had hair loss and skin lesions. In September of that year, several walrus carcasses with the unusual skin lesions were discovered at a haulout near Point Lay. The unusual mortality event was declared in December of 2011. NOAA reports that the surveillance efforts over the last couple of years resulted in just three new cases of the unknown disease in walruses. Spiegel confirms that the exact cause for the unusual mortality event has yet to be identified.
We have done a lot of testing for a wide range of possible causes of this disease. We still do not know what caused it. So we still will be doing some testing and monitoring. But at this point, we think maybe it's a variety of factors combined.
In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Over the weekend, the Western Mining Action Network held a panel discussion in Anchorage on the development of large-scale mines in British Columbia that could impact the Taku, Stikine, and Unuk Rivers, all prolific salmon producers for Alaska. Chris Zimmer is the Alaska Rivers Without Borders campaign director. He says there are a number of mines proposed for BC, and two of the most concerning are the Tulsa-Quechief mine and the much larger Kerr Supparetz Mitchell or KSM prospect, which is half the size of the Pebble mine proposal and 50 times larger than Tulsaqua.
And it has a massive acid mine drainage problem. They're going to have to store 2 billion tons of acid mine-generating rock. And they're also going to have to treat contaminated water at times at the rate of 118,000 gallons a minute. It's unprecedented to do this. So the issue there is we're really worried about downstream water contamination and the ability of that mine and that company to handle that much waste and that much water. There's no mine on earth we know that has been in a salmon area that has that amount of water to treat and this much potential acid mine generation.
Why are these mining proposals ramping up now?
Well, part of it is the price of gold. When I started this work 15 years ago, gold was probably at $300 or $400 an ounce. And now with it well into the thousands, that's really driving a lot of this. And you also have, I'd say, two big pushes from BC. One, a very strong pro-mining push from the BC government. Premier Christy Clark said she wants to see 8 or 10 mines in 8 or 10 years. And then you also have, over the last couple of years, both Canada at the federal level and BC at the provincial level have, I'd say, significantly cut their permitting regulations, had significantly weakened some of the environmental laws. So these mines are going through much faster in the permitting reviews. They're not being held to as rigorous a standard. So we really see this as a tremendous mining binge in the BC side of the Southeast Alaska BC transboundary region here.
Describe what the concern is for Alaska.
The biggest issue is we're downstream of all of this. If the rivers flowed the other way, it'd be quite different. So the concern is for our water quality, our fish, and the jobs, the livelihoods, the culture that depends on those. Basically, what we have up in the headwaters, these watersheds now, is what I'd call a toxic time bomb. If these mines are built, you're going to have millions to billions of tons of acid mine generating rock, constant water flow. And in the case of KSM, the company says they're going to probably have to treat the water for 200 years, when most people think they're probably going to have to treat it forever. So forever is a tough concept. You know, who is going to pay for forever? Who is going to be up there forever to clean this up? So Alaska is going to get no benefits from these mines. The benefits all flow to Canada, and we get nothing but the risk to our downstream fisheries.
This is a trans-nation border issue. Water's coming from Canada and flowing into U.S. waters, into Alaska. Have you spoken to anyone with the Alaska congressional delegation about this?
We, over the last couple of months, we've put together what I call a pretty loose partnership or coalition of almost all the stakeholders in these watersheds, from commercial fishermen to tribes to environmentalists. And we did send a team back to Washington, D.C. in March. And the response there was excellent from the federal agencies and from our congressional delegation. They saw the risk. They listened to everybody. And the congressional delegation immediately fired off a letter to Secretary John Kerry saying this is an international issue and we need the State Department to engage directly with the Canadian government. Because this isn't Alaska, BC. This is really the U.S. and Canada. And the border creates some problems of jurisdiction. The mines are in another country. So the only way we thought we can get some traction, get our concerns addressed, is to make this a federal government to federal government level. Secretary Kerry has a few other things on his plate these days, so we haven't gotten an answer back yet. But we've been working with lower level officials in the State Department to try to engage with Canada. So that type of diplomacy is slow. It's kind of painful, but it's really the only way for the Alaska, I think, to get satisfaction, to get its concerns addressed. And, you know, Canada's probably going to dig its heels in here a bit. So this could be a bit of a tough battle here.
Chris Zimmer is the Alaska Rivers Without Borders campaign director. Robert Sanderson is first vice president of the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes and was at the mining conference. He also is concerned that Alaskans don't have legal standing to address Canadian mining.
So that's one thing we're working on now is to start a dialogue with the tribal First Nations first. In Canada, and to encourage them to work closely with their government, their provincial government. And on this side of the border in the U.S., we're working with our congressional delegation and hopefully with the state of Alaska, which I feel could do more.
Something that may help the BC mining operations is a 2011 initiative to sign revenue sharing agreements with Canadian First Nations or tribes. Chieftain Metals Corporation, based in Toronto, is the owner of the Tulsacoa Chief Mine. Company President and CEO Victor Wyprysky was traveling and could not be reached for comment today, but a recent posting on the company's website highlights the results of a February water quality study. Conducted at the request of the British Columbia Ministry of the Environment, the study tested four sites on the Tulsacoa River near the confluence of the Taku River near the mine site. Chinook, Coho, Sockeye Salmon, and Dolly Varden were tested. Researchers reportedly found no discernible impact in fish tissue samples from historic mining discharge. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unprecedented shorebird sighting in Southeast.
Doug and I were both like, it sure looks like a match, but gosh, it just this doesn't seem right.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack and stroke, miscarriage and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
About 15,000 State of Alaska employees will wait another day for their paychecks due to a banking glitch. Direct deposits were not processed as expected by U.S. Bank today, according to the Administration Department. Spokesman Andy Mills says the error was made by the bank. U.S. Bank is a new vendor for the state, and this is the first time the company has processed the direct deposits. Mills calls it a big disappointment that they couldn't get it right the first time.
While our folks processed and did their portion of this payroll transmittal information, U.S. Bank did not complete their part, and so we're looking to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Mills says U.S. Bank has agreed to pay any fees employees accrue on their personal bank accounts due to the problem. A Juneau couple has likely made the first verified sighting of a long-billed curlew in Alaska. North America's largest shorebird, rarely seen in this part of the country, may become the next entry on the checklist of Alaska birds. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Martina Kallenberger and husband Doug Sandvik were birdwatching at Boy Scout Camp on May 3rd. Kallenberger says they started around 11 a.m., walking the trail and beach, and were going through the meadow around 1:30.
We were actually watching a flock of Lapland longspurs when we noticed these two shorebirds on a little rise by the stream, and one of them was a whimbrel, which we recognized, and the other one was just shockingly different.
Kallenberger and Sandvik watched the bird for at least an hour, taking pictures and referring to guidebooks. They had an inkling it might be the long-billed curlew.
During the course of the time we were sitting there, I was going through the bird book thinking, well, gosh, it can't be this. It could be, no, it just, and I kept coming back to the curlew, and Doug and I were both like, it sure looks like a match, but gosh, it just, this doesn't seem right.
They had reason to be hesitant.
It is very rare.
That's Steve Heinel. He's a lifelong birder and sits on the University of Alaska Museum's Alaska Checklist Committee, which maintains and decides what goes on the official list of birds documented in Alaska.
There had only been three previous reports of a long-billed curlew in Alaska, but none of them were photographed.
This is what makes Kallenberger and Sandvik's sighting a likely entry on the list. Heinel says a sighting can be verified with a photograph or specimen. There are currently 501 species on the checklist of Alaska birds.
The long-billed curlew would potentially be number 502.
Long-billed curlews spend winters in Mexico and on the west coast of North America. They breed throughout the West, from southern Canada to New Mexico. Heinel says the bird in Juneau likely flew farther than it needed to.
I think it overshot its normal breeding range, which means it migrated too far north. Often birds that migrate to the wrong place are younger birds, so it perhaps was on its first northward migration.
That's part of what makes watching birds so great, Heinel says, and why the checklist of Alaska birds will likely never stop growing.
They have wings, and they fly off in the wrong direction, and there's always potential to see something you've never seen before.
Kallenberger and Sandvik are proof of this. Kallenberger says they've spent many hours birdwatching at Boy Scout camp and never imagined they'd see a long-billed curlew.
Anytime I see a new species, it's just hugely exciting. But to see something as unusual as this bird in this place was even doubly so.
For Kallenberger and Sandvik, it was a matter of being in the right place at the right time. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Things look a little different in Mountain View. The community in North Anchorage just finished their 25th annual community-wide cleanup. This year, they were joined by other city residents to improve a local park as well. KSKA's Ann Hillman has more.
Behind cleanup coordinator and longtime Mountain View resident Scott Kohlhaas, massive machines scoop mattresses and old couches into dumpsters.
Yeah, we're taking everything from hazmat and electronics, car batteries, tires, refrigerators, metal, general trash.
Over a week, the community collected about 200 tons of waste to be thrown out or recycled.
There's a lot of mobility here, a lot of transition. So there's a lot of stuff in apartments that people have moved from, a lot of stuff in the streets, a lot of stuff in the alleys. So it's a constant struggle.
But Kohlhaas says when residents come together to clear it away, it improves the community atmosphere.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt there's more pride. There's more pride. It's the broken window syndrome. If we fix the broken window, then everyone cares and it's going to be a better place. And if we leave it broken, they're going to break all the other windows, you know. So I think it makes a big difference, and I think people are proud of the way it looks right now.
Though it's the 25th annual community-wide cleanup in Mountain View, it's the first ever neighborhood park fix-it at Davis Park. The park is a small plot of wooded land with trails running through it next to a giant playground. Community members initiated the event to improve the safety of the area. Mountain View Lions Club member Amy Orange Posma is dragging bags of trash filled with things like power cords and pillows from abandoned homeless camps in the park. She says historically, many homeless people have lived here, but the area is for everyone.
This is a marvelous little chunk of trees, wild nature, and you got a street right there. So schools over that way, housing, it's just a lovely little refuge in Anchorage. All the parks are.
Tony Lucan and members of his church group from South Anchorage are clipping back brush from the trail that winds through the woods.
Oh, just to create some visibility into the woods, you know, make it a little bit more safe and give people a little more clearance, whether it be wildlife or, you know, any other kinds of dangers, possible hazards.
Anchorage Parks and Recreation Volunteer Coordinator Myrna Estrada explains that trimming the brush helps give residents a place they feel comfortable gathering.
Parks are great in our development and creating bonds with our friends and our families and our community.
A volunteer snips at a sapling right on top of Estrada.
That was a treat. See, we're bonding with nature.
Estrada escapes the incident without injury. The cleanup is attracting new people to the park as well, like Rebecca Castleman, who recently moved in just a few miles away.
We thought it was our first time here at the park, and we wanted to see what it was all about and maybe help clear some of the trails, and then we can enjoy it later, too, with our two little girls.
The park project marked the end of this year's citywide cleanup week. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A string of motorcycle collisions have taken 5 lives in the South Central area during the past several weeks. And on a narrow highway shoulder near Palmer last week, riders lined up for an impromptu memorial service at the site of an accident on May 3rd that claimed the lives of 3 members of the Harley Owners Group Alaska chapter. They placed flowers and flags at the site. Roy Callender is one of the riders.
Young man, probably devastated that was making this turn here, that got pushed into the oncoming traffic, which happened to be our friends. Wonderful people. We've spent a lot of time with these people over the years, and certainly are really missing them and hurting really bad. So it gives us a chance to come together and hopefully help the grieving family members.
James and Sabrina Carlisle of Wasilla, riding on one motorcycle, were killed in that wreck, as was Elaine Lowe of Anchorage. A 4th rider survived. 4 of the 5 motorcycle fatalities so far this year have happened in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley. 28-year-old Cameron McDonald was killed when an alleged drunk driver collided with McDonald's Yamaha on a Wasilla roadway in April. The driver of the Jeep that hit McDonald has been charged with manslaughter. And an Anchorage man, 27-year-old Robert Furlan, was struck and killed when a car collided with his motorcycle at a downtown intersection in Anchorage. Last year, there were 9 fatalities due to motorcycle accidents. Next month, Seattle area mountain climber Bruce Stobie is going to attempt to get to the top of Denali. That alone is impressive, but Stobie faces an additional challenge. He's blind. Ashley Gross of KPLU in Seattle brings us the story.
Everything changed for Bruce Stobie on November 5, 1983. He was one of 9 college kids packed into a truck driving through the Cascades when the driver lost control. The last thing Stobie ever saw was the truck flying into the air. He thought he was going to die. Stobie smashed face first into the roll bar of the vehicle before being tossed out.
Detached both the retinas in both eyes, and the sight loss was pretty much instantaneous.
He lay in the hospital recovering. He was trying to come to terms with what it means to be a blind person, so he decided to set some goals. He wanted to finish college, he wanted to run a marathon, and he wanted to climb a mountain.
Rainier, you know, it had been something I'd always wanted to do, so, you know, I put these things into my bucket list to accomplish.
But he says the first time he went hiking after losing his eyesight was terrible.
You know, there was all these obstacles, stumbling over things. You know, I had the grieving processes going through, and I, you know, it's like I loved being in the mountains when I could see just to look at stuff, and I couldn't do that. And so it was just like, why would I want to do this? This is not fun.
He gave up his climbing dreams for a long time. But about 9 years ago, he was ready to try again. He convinced a former Boeing coworker, Ron Fleck, who taught mountaineering classes in his spare time, to take him along. They've been climbing together ever since.
So you exercise today?
Yeah.
Good.
On a recent sunny day, Stobie meets up at a trailhead near Issaquah with Fleck and another climbing buddy, Charlie Sonkrant. On this day, Stobie got up at 2:45 in the morning and has already worked out for 2.5 hours. Now he's ready to charge up this mountain, but he can't do it alone.
And a lot of 4-foot steps, just kind of take a normal stride. Okay. There's a root on your left, sticking up by your left foot. A couple there, that's it.
Fleck and Sonkrant are Stobie's eyes when they're on the trail. Fleck leads and Stobie follows him, holding onto a rope attached to Fleck's backpack in one hand and a cane in the other. Sonkrant follows behind, making sure Stobie doesn't go off the edge.
The rocks are closer together, so you probably just want to take a lot more in the way of baby steps. Okay, Bruce?
Yeah.
Stobie says he has a good mental memory and can picture the views, but the joy he gets from this comes from physical exertion and pushing himself.
I like seeing how fast I can go. I think if I could see, I'd be wanting to move a lot faster.
Still, it's one thing to hike the Issaquah Alps and another to navigate around crevasses and ice falls to get to the top of Rainier. 5 years ago, Stobie signed up to climb the mountain. His guide, Mike Haugen, was looking over his client's medical information when he saw the word blind on Stobie's sheet.
I kind of did a double take at it. And, you know, maybe he's got a really, you know, high prescription for his glasses or something like that. And I went and talked to one of the owners, and they said, oh, I forgot to tell you, he's, you know, blind. It kind of went into panic mode. You know, I had never guided a blind climber before.
I'm not sure what selection process the guiding company went through to match him with me, but it was a serendipitous choice.
He just gained this trust, and I trusted him in terms of following my directions. And we got to the point where he would walk up to an edge of a crevasse, and I would say, you know, take a small right step and a big left step, and he would just step right over the crevasse, and it was pretty amazing.
They made it to the top, and now they're teaming up again with one other guide for an even more challenging task. It takes 3 weeks to get to the top of Denali and back. They'll be carrying 70-pound packs and pulling sleds loaded with gear and food for much of the way. Stobie's wife, Gwyn, is trying not to think about the dangers.
I thought that climbing for him was like a fancy hike, and it wasn't until I started seeing some of the pictures that I realized that this was serious stuff, and I'm more than a little nervous.
There are a few other blind mountaineers who have gotten to the top of Denali, but the mountain can be deadly even for people with perfect eyesight.
We're going off four.
Back on the trail near Issaquah, Stobie and his friends are now heading down.
All right, so we're going to step off this route. It's about a foot down. You might want to go left sideways. Yep.
So you can falling get... facing downhill is more dangerous, so Stobie walks with extra care.
And it's like you're doing two steps almost. You're kind of pushing your foot
down
and then pushing it all the way down.
Yeah. It's like, is this a safe one? No? No, readjust. Yes. You know, go ahead and put your weight on it.
Stobie is still fundraising for his expedition. It will cost about $45,000, more than it would if he could see, because he has to have two guides.
There's points, you know, definitely it's like, oh, I wish I could see, this would be so easy. But, you know, this is who I am, this is what I have to deal with, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, live with it.
Stobie hopes that in a month and a half, he'll stand at the top of Denali and feel and hear the wind and the calls of triumph from his climbing partners. Then he'll come down carefully and most likely set another goal to reach. I'm Ashley Gross reporting.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Jacqueline Estes and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Rosemary Alexandra and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, and Ashley Gross in Seattle. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At SalmonLove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. SalmonLove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.